From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Sharing a hotel room with your mates in the band Faces wasn't easy. Rod Stewart and Kenny Jones went to sleep too early. Ronnie Lane wanted to shag your bird, and Ron Wood already had. At least that's how Ian McLagan tells it. Today on Fresh Air, we'll hear from McLagan about his days playing keyboards for the British rock band and his life today. After Faces broke up in 75, he toured with Bob Dylan and the Rolling Stones and recorded with Bonnie Raitt, Joe Cocker, and others. He's just produced a 4-CD box set of Faces recordings. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Open Water. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Orlando, Florida is into its first full work week after the onslaught of Hurricane Charley. Pat Duggins of member station WMFE says it's still unclear how quickly the region can recover.
Disaster managers say how this week goes depends on how fast the electricity is being reestablished. And depending on where you live, it could be until August the 24th before the lights come on. Here in Orlando, it could be sometime this week. In the outlying areas of Orange County and Seminole County and Volusia County, it could be as late as this coming Saturday. So until that power comes on, local law enforcers say that people don't have those simple creature comforts that calm them down.
Pat Duggins reporting from Orlando. The Federal Emergency Management Agency says more than 76,000 meals and snacks have been served to people made homeless by the hurricane and to emergency workers. About 23,000 people are reported to be staying in shelters. President Bush is planning to redeploy as many as 70,000 troops stationed in Europe and Asia. He announced the move today in Cincinnati. Marianne Zalesnik reports from member station WNKU.
President Bush says the goal is a more flexible force ready to fight the wars and terrorist enemies of the 21st century.
It will reduce the stress on our troops and our military families. Although we'll still have a significant presence overseas, under the plan I'm announcing today, over the next 10 years, we will bring home about 60,000 to 70,000 uniformed personnel.
The president made the announcement at the Veterans of Foreign Wars Convention in Cincinnati. Officials say the redeployments will take effect over the next decade and won't affect U.S. troop levels in Iraq. Mr. Bush was on a campaign swing through Ohio and Michigan. Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry will address the group on Wednesday. For NPR News, I'm Marianne Zalesnik.
Delegates at Iraq's National Conference voted overwhelmingly today to send a delegation to the embattled city of Najaf. The Washington Post's Rajiv Chandrasekharan in Baghdad says they'll try to convince Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr to do three things.
To disband his militia, to vacate a holy Shiite shrine that his militia has been holed up in now for more than a week, and to participate in a nonviolent way in Iraq's political process. This delegation is scheduled to leave Baghdad early Tuesday morning and is supposed to meet with Sadr in Najaf in midday on Tuesday.
The Washington Post Rajiv Chandrasekharan in Baghdad. In stocks today, stock prices closed higher on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 129 points to close at 9,954 in active trading. Advances led declines by 3-1. The Nasdaq gained 25 to close at 1782. This is NPR News. A wildfire continues to burn in a historic Northern California gold mining town. The wind-driven fire is being fueled by dead trees on the ground. Jason Margolis reports from member station KQED.
Nearly all the 300-plus residents from French Gulch have been evacuated as the fire has ripped through the heart of their small town. The blaze is now about 10% contained and has burned more than 9,000 acres. There have been no reported injuries, but 22 homes and two commercial structures have been destroyed. Almost 2,000 firefighters from California and Oregon are trying to control the wildfire. The United States Forest Service is expecting full containment by Friday afternoon. Another nearby fire, also in Shasta County, is now fully contained. That fire burned through 10,400 acres and was started by a spark from a lawnmower. The cause of the French Gulch fire remains unknown. For NPR News, I'm Jason Margolis in Sacramento.
Results of a weekend election in Venezuela indicate that President Hugo Chavez has survived an attempt to recall him. Venezuela's National Elections Council said that with 90% of the votes counted, Chavez retained his seat by a wide margin. Opposition groups accused Chavez supporters of vote fraud, but former President Jimmy Carter, who led a team of election monitors, said the election appeared to be fair. The results were also endorsed by the head of the Organization of American States, which also sent teams to observe the election. Chavez was widely supported by Venezuela's poor, but middle and upper class opponents accused him of being an authoritarian. In stocks today, the S&P 500 gained 14 points to close at 1,079. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Aircast Foundation, working to support medicine and science through the funding of orthopedic research on the web at aircastfoundation.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guest Ian McLagan may not be a household name, but if you like rock and roll, chances are pretty good you've heard his keyboards. McLagan started playing music in London in the mid-60s, when bands like the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and the Animals were taking over the charts. McLagan played keyboards in the band Small Faces and then Faces, which featured a young bluesy singer named Rod Stewart. McLagan's musical life extended well beyond Faces. He wrote a memoir called All the Rage that tells of his four decades in rock, playing with legends of the business like the Stones and Bob Dylan, and living out rock star cliches, including sex, drugs, and trashing hotel rooms. His life is less frenzied now. He lives in Austin, Texas with his wife, Kim, and he's still making music, recording and playing local clubs with his group, The Bump Band. McLagan has now produced a box set of Faces recordings for Rhino Records. It includes their hits and some rare recordings from rehearsals and BBC broadcasts. In addition to Ian McLagan and Rod Stewart, Faces included guitarist Ron Wood, now in the Rolling Stones, songwriter and bass player Ronnie Lane, who died of MS in 1997, and Kenny Jones, who later played drums with The Who. Here's Faces' only hit in the U.S., Stay With Me. McLagan, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Dave. Nice to be talking to you.
You came of age at a time in the mid-60s that was really the dawn of British rock and roll and had been doing music all these years. Tell us how you got into music.
Well, that's an interesting... Actually, my mum paid for me to have piano lessons, but I didn't want to have piano lessons. It took me several years to figure out that that's what I was going to do with the rest of my life, but... I wanted to play snooker with my pals, and who eventually formed a skiffle group, and which I joined as the T-chest bass player.
Now I think you got to explain for an American audience what sniffle and snooker is.
Snooker is
snooker.
What pool? Yeah, snooker is what pool should be, with a much larger table and smaller, tighter pockets.
Okay. Snooker, right?
Yes. And they used to have a lot of snooker halls in England at that time, very popular. And I still like to play whenever I can. Skiffle was what preceded the Beatles. In England, Lonnie Donegan, who just died last year or this year, Lonnie Donegan was in a a Dixieland jazz band in England, the Ken Collier Band, and then the Chris Barber Band. And he, in the intermission, he would play his version of blues. I call it kind of speed folk. It was very up-tempo and influenced by the blues and Lead Belly and all those guys, but it wasn't the blues. It was kind of, it was folk. It was skiffle. That's what it was called, and it became very popular. And almost everyone in my generation who was, ended up in a band started out playing washboard or guitar or banjo or T-chest bass. It was very kind of, it was like punk in its way, you know, that it was very, you know, up and at it. It was all kind of and made up instruments. Didn't have to be talented. You just had to sort of bash away. And bit by bit, I kind of fumbled my way into playing. By I got a guitar and I started playing a basic Chuck Berry riff, and then transferred that to the piano, which was sitting in the sitting room still, and which I hadn't played. But then when I heard Green Onions, Booker T and the MGs, I thought, well, boy, this is the sound for me. I've got to get one of those, whatever it is. And it turned out to be a Hammond organ.
And you were in love.
Yeah.
You got
and I haven't stopped being in love.
When you were a teenager in the early 60s and just scratching around in the music business, and it was a time when British rock was really just taking form. I mean, the Beatles and the Stones and the Who were all just getting going. And give us a sense of what the scene was like. I mean, were you aware that something kind of new and different, exciting was happening?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was in the air. You know, I loved the Stones. I used to see them every Sunday after I discovered them, you know, and then I'd follow them. I'd catch them on a Wednesday somewhere else, you know, and then I'd find they'd be playing somewhere else on a Saturday night, and I'd go there. And then when The Who came out, actually, I met Pete very early on at Jim Marshall's drum shop, as it was, before he made guitar amps. I met Mitch Mitchell. He used to serve behind the counter there, who was later ended up as drummer with Jimi Hendrix, of course. And I'm, you know, there was a buzz going on, and Townsend was like, first time I met him, he said, "So how you doing? How's your what you know, like, what's your band?" He was all interested in what I was doing. I was interested in what he was doing, and you know, we'd all heard the music, you know, and we wanted to play it. And then the next thing was to try and get gigs. And then, you know, I became manager and a kind of agent of my band, although I wasn't the singer. I was just the rhythm keyboard player. But it was very exciting. You just constantly trying to get gigs and playing and finding out where the clubs were and checking other bands out and thinking, they ain't that good. We're better than them, you know. It was, I was too committed to know that, you know, I was just having the best time.
You were listening to a lot of American blues. Were a lot of British teenagers into that then? I mean, I don't think American kids were so much. Where did you get the records?
Well, they were difficult to find. You know, the thing is, one night, Humphrey Lyttelton had a jazz program. I think it was a Monday night on radio. What was BBC One, I suppose it was then. And he played Muddy Waters live at Newport, Hoochie Coochie Man. And that pretty much changed my life. That album, which I eventually bought with great difficulty from the local record store in Hounslow, where I lived, that and Thelonious Monk, Blue Monk's Moods, just changed my life. And I figured, well, Monk's a great blues player, and whoever is playing with Muddy is a great blues player. That was, of course, Otis Spann. And Otis is probably my main influence on the piano, you know.
So you're with the Mule Skinners. They split up, and you find yourself bandless and then get recruited to an established group with a record contract, right? Small Faces.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well, strangely, I was in another band in between, and but they weren't that keen to work, and the van broke down one night, and they kind of laughed, and we were supposed to be going up to Scotland, which is, you know, like 6 or 7 hour drive back then before the motorways, you know, and so we set up again, off again the next night and next afternoon, and the van broke down again. I said, "That's it, I quit." And so I was depressed, and I went to see my girlfriend that night. And on the way back, I bumped into a friend of mine, Phil, who said, "So how's the band?" I said, "Oh, I just left." And he said, oh, you should join the Small Faces. I said, oh, yeah, that's very funny, Phil. I thought, sarcastic. And the next morning, their manager called me, and that afternoon I joined the band.
Was that just a coincidence?
Yeah.
Amazing.
He just, because they had that one hit, you see, and I'd seen him on television. My dad said, check this band out. They're great. And I looked at him. I thought, boy, they're great. The great singer, and they look great. Well, that's the sort of band I'd like to be in, you know. And within, a few months, I was a member.
Sometimes dreams come true.
Unbelievably true, yeah. It felt like I was just plucked out of nowhere.
The group had a certain visual style. What did you look like?
Oh, we were pretty sharp. I mean, apart from anything, we were all the same height. None of us were over 5'6".
Thus the Small Faces.
Yes, but although the guy I replaced was taller, and that wasn't why they threw him out. He just wasn't much of an organ player. But they read a review of the band I was in previously, and they quoted me as saying, they quoted the reviewer said that I played really good, but they had a photo of the lead singer who was much handsomer than me. And they thought, well, he's obviously a great player and he looks great, let's get him. And when they met me, they were a bit surprised by the change in face. But I was the right size.
My guest is musician Ian McLaughlin. We'll talk some more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with musician Ian McLaughlin. In the 1960s and 70s, he played keyboards for the British bands Small Faces and then later Faces. He also toured with the Rolling Stones and Bob Dylan, and he's produced a new box set of Faces songs, which has just been released. Your big hit in America with Small Faces was Ichiku Park, and maybe we should hear that. Tell us about that song.
Well, strangely enough, Steve Marriott and Ronnie Lane wrote together, and it was hard to break into that partnership, although occasionally I would write with kind of a little germ of mine that Ronnie would help, and then that would come out as Marriott Lane McLaggen. I could never just separate them. But in fact, I didn't realize that Ronnie Lane wrote that song, almost as one of his. You know, the way a partnership works, it's one or the other mainly, and the other one helps. Well, that was a Ronnie Lane composition. And years later, when I was living in L.A., he called me from Austin in 1990 and asked if I would tour Japan with him. And I said, I'd love to. I said, just one thing, Ronnie. He said, what's that? I said, let's not do Ichiku Park. I said, I'm sick of that song. He said, but Mac, I wrote that. I said, I'm sorry, I hate it.
Do you really hate the song?
Yeah. Well, see, I don't think it is all too beautiful. I'm a lucky guy, I'm a happy guy, but I don't think it's all too beautiful.
Not so much like what most of the music you were doing.
Right.
Well, with apologies to our guest, Ian McLaggen, let's hear Ichiku Park from Small Faces.
A bridge of sights to rest my eyes in shades of green, under dreaming spires to Ichiku Park. That's where I've been.
What did you do there?
I got high.
What did you feel there?
Well, I cried.
But why the tears there?
Tell you why.
It's all too beautiful. It's all too beautiful. It's all too beautiful. It's all too beautiful.
I feel inclined to blow my mind. Get up, feed the ducks with a bun. They all come out to groove about, be nice and have fun in the sun.
That was Ichiku Park by Small Faces. On keyboards was my guest, Ian McLaggen. Ichiku Park is a song that's sort of more in the psychedelic vein. rather than the blues that you were playing. Is that what you don't like about it?
Well, it was, yes, but it's that, you know, we were, Ronnie, Steve, and I took acid in 1966 and took acid again the next week and took a lot of acid over a period of time. And the music did change, and I think in some ways for the worse. I mean, it's like movies made around that time. Some of them are so hopeless. I can't look at them now. They're just so desperately trying to prove that they've taken acid, you know. And it's All Too Beautiful was the chorus of Ichigo Pie, and it's that whole thing, you know. I don't think you have to prove it. You know, the experience was pleasant, and now let's move on. Let's go back to what we were doing. But we never did, really.
It's also remarkable that you were in a band that had a lot of hits. I mean, you 14 hits in the UK, if I remember. And yet, you didn't make any money. You couldn't even afford your own apartments for a long time. Why?
We had management. We had very good management, or should we say thieves. We were just unlucky in that way. I mean, we were enjoying ourselves, you know, making the music and touring, but we never actually managed to get any royalties publishing or any money from the gigs. We were paid a wage of £20 a week, and that's pretty much... We had our we were living in a house together at that time. That was paid, and our food was paid, and our clothes were paid, and that was about it. That's all we got out of it.
You were awfully young. I mean, you were, what, 20, 21, and some of the guys were younger.
Yeah, I was the oldest, yeah, and Kenny was 16. Yeah, I mean, we were ignorant about business. I mean, boy. And, I mean, we were so thrilled to be able to, you know, play music, really, and... that it never occurred to us. We never had a bank account, and our parents kind of suspected it, and went to have a meeting with our manager, Don Arden, and he threw a red herring in front of me. He said, "People in show business spend money, and they've spent theirs, and anyway, they're on drugs." And the parents then just left the office so downhearted, you know. And of course, we weren't on drugs; we were smoking pot.
Right.
You know.
It was suggested that the
suggestion was, or what they thought was, that we were on heroin or something. You know, that was the end of the inquiry into where the money was. You know,
and you were generating a fortune for them, right?
Well, yeah, we were. Well, we were then on £50 a week, so I suppose that was some improvement. We still didn't get record royalties. In fact, we didn't get record royalties from Immediate till 1997. And from Decca Records, which was the earlier period, till 1991, I think it was.
Well, Ian McLagan, we were talking about your association with the group Small Faces, which split up when its lead singer, Steve Marriott, decided to leave and join Peter Frampton in a group, Humble Pie. And then you recombined and formed the group Faces. I mean, how did that happen?
Actually, we wouldn't have called ourselves Faces because we wanted to disassociate ourselves from Small Faces, because we figured, you know, we had Ronnie Wood joining, Kenny, Ronnie, and I, and Rod Stewart, and we figured the music will be different. It just, you know, just naturally will be different, and we weren't going to use the name, but the American company, Warner Brothers, we signed in England, but the American branch, or the main part of the company, weren't willing to sign us unless we kept the name Small Faces. So, in fact, the album... Our first album, called First Step, came out as Small Faces in America and as Faces in England, because the English company said, "No, we understand, but look, we can drop the small, we just have to keep Faces." And I think we thought we might be able to change the name after the first album. I think it was pretty stupid, but we would have been, you know, the strawberry newspaper egg or something, you know. I don't know. But Faces worked anyway, because it kept the lineage of Ronnie, Kenny, and me going, you know.
You had four albums and a lot of hits. You toured in the States. Let's listen to a track from the new CD box set. I thought we would listen to "You're So Rude," which is a song you collaborated on with the late Ronnie Lane. You want to say a word about this, Tim?
Yes. I only wrote one song with Ronnie, actually, in all the years we were together. And he came over to my house, and I had a beautiful harmonium, a pump organ, in the hallway of the house, because I was having work done on the studio and I couldn't get it in there at that moment. So it was, you had to kind of squeeze past it. And he said, "Oh, that's nice." I said, "Yeah, listen to how it played." And I played him something I'd written on the harmonium. And he sat down and he wrote the lyrics to "You're So Rude" in about 10 minutes flat. And it was a true story how he and his girlfriend were caught at it at her. His mum's house. Anyway, at his parents' house. And he suggests that he'll wet his socks, pretend he just got caught in the rain. Anyway, it's a true story.
Okay, so let's listen to "You're So Rude." This is the group Faces. It was originally recorded on "A Nod Is As Good As a Wink" and is on the new 4-CD box set.
My mom, she likes you. She thinks you're swell. Got the makings of a dance hall girl. Your low-cut frock and your bird's nest hair. Still a little heels. As though there's nobody in. They've all gone out to see my Auntie Renee. Don't you worry, you just come right in. I'm sure we'll pass the time till they come home. Well, let me take your coat, kick off your shoes, warm your toes. Try the sofa.
That was "You're So Rude" from the group Faces. It's included on the new CD box set produced by our guest, Ian McLagan, who played keyboards. You know, one of the things that I like about that track, apart from the organ that you play at the top, is that it is not Rod Stewart on the vocal, who people have long associated with Faces, but Ronnie Lane, the late Ronnie Lane, the bass player. He gives a great delivery there, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. I mean, it's tongue-in-cheek, you know, you can hear his smile, you know. He was a very cheeky boy, Ronnie, and I met the girl in question, funny enough, previously. I'd met her when we were in Small Faces together. But he was the most prolific writer with the Faces and Small Faces. And I figured this box set, Five Guys Walk Into a Bar, ...
Right.
Should honour him as much as anything, because he's not around, he's not here to be honoured in person, and he's very much loved by all who knew him and know him or know his music. And so the album, the box set is dedicated to Ronnie.
Keyboard player Ian McLagan. He's just produced a CD box set of his former band, Faces. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with keyboard player Ian McLagan of the British rock band Faces, and film critic David Edelstein has a review of the new film Open Water about two scuba divers stranded at sea. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with Ian McLagan. He played keyboards with the British rock band Faces, and he's just produced a CD box set of their recordings, rehearsals, and live performances. He's also written a memoir, All the Rage, about his four decades in rock and roll. The name of the new CD box set is called Faces, Five Guys Walk Into a Bar. And in a way, you're five guys who walked into a bar and almost never left. I mean, drinking was a very big part of this band. Is it true that you actually set up a bar on stage behind the drums?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we had drinks anyway. We figured, well, there was one of the guys was our tour manager, had nothing to do during the show. And so we dressed him up as a barman and had a bar, you know, a bar built, which we carried with us. And in fact, Glenn Matlock is quoted, and I think it's funny, I don't know if it's true, but he said that during the drum solo in Losing You, we all went to the bar and stood there and chatted, ignoring Kenny thumping away there, and then walked back on stage as if to start, and Rod said, as if to say, well, you imagined, he said it, well, should we have one more? And we went back to the bar and left him there. I can imagine that happened, but I don't remember it.
Well, let's listen to a cut from Faces. This is one that I think, to me, captures a lot of the energy of some of those live performances, although it's a studio recording. It's Too Bad. It was originally done on A Nod Is As Good As a Wink. So let's hear Faces and Too Bad.
All we wanted to do was to socialize. Oh, you know it's a shame.
That was Too Bad with the group Faces. On keyboards was our guest, Ian McLagan, who is also the producer of a new 4-CD box set of Faces songs called Five Guys Walk Into a Bar. This is also a time when you did a lot of touring in the States, and did a fair amount of hotel room bashing. I mean, you write at one point, it was not possible to walk into an identical room in 20 different cities without wanting to hurt it just a little.
Just a little, yeah.
And then later on, you note that when you were going to a place where the only place was a Holiday Inn, that you said that in Holiday Inns, because of past damage and room wrecking, the Faces had been banned from all Holiday Inns. And in this case, you would check in as Fleetwood Mac and they didn't know any difference. Is that true?
Yeah, it's true. And then eventually they sussed us out and we changed our name to Family. And I think we got them banned as well. Yeah, I mean,
help us understand why rock stars trash hotel rooms.
You don't understand it. It's because, I mean, see, now Holiday Inn is a very nice hotel these days. Back then, I mean, they were, the ones we stayed in were always on the freeway, you know, on like near a freeway intersection. You know, you couldn't walk out from there to go anywhere. And every single room was identical in every city. Same horrible wallpaper, but they were cheap and they were cheerful and they were clean, you know. So you'd walk in and you just think, oh, God, you know, you just want something different. Just, I mean, just a carpet that wasn't a shag carpet, orange and green shag carpets. You know, it was, they made the carpets like that so that in case anyone threw up, no one would notice, I think.
So you did your own remodeling.
Well, it just got out of boredom, you know, and it didn't matter, it seemed, because, you know, I mean, we'd pay for the damage, but it just didn't matter because, you know, there'd be another one tonight, you know, and it'd be another city, be 300 miles away, another one identical that was clean. So the bed wasn't broke. We used to subtly break the room and leave it, like, fixed so that someone would pick up the phone and there'd be no microphone in it so they couldn't hear. And, you know, you could undo the door handle so that you'd check in and they couldn't get out.
One of the other colorful pieces of your life is that your wife, Kim, you, well, I guess, stole from The Who's Keith Moon.
Actually, I didn't really steal her, and she wouldn't accept that either. I mean, she had had enough of Keith. Keith had been pretty brutal to her over a long period of time, and she left, and I grabbed her.
Okay.
And I grab her still.
And Keith didn't take this easily. I mean, is it true that he once paid a guy, some thug, 200 pounds to break your fingers?
Yeah, unfortunately, I knew the guy, but and I knew he was capable of it, but Pete Townsend got wind of it and paid the guy another 200 pounds not to do it. So the guy did well. Keith never knew, and I carried on. I'm still playing. Yeah, Uncle Pete, God bless him.
Uncle Pete Townsend, who, right.
Yeah.
Did you ever kind of reconcile with Keith Moon before he died?
No. I mean, in person, he would be fine with me. But, you know, it made him very unhappy. He loved Kim. He just didn't know how to show her love or, you know, he was a very, I mean, really, if anyone was schizophrenic, I'd say Keith was. But I got on well with Keith every time I saw him. And I was a good friend to him before, you know, Kim left him. That's how I met Kim through him. But I met Kim just before they were married, you know. And I thought, what a beautiful girl. And every time I saw her, I thought, what a beautiful girl. What's she doing with him? And then I started hanging out when my first marriage fell apart. I used to hang out with Keith and Kim. And he eventually would fall asleep. And Kim and I would spend all day and all night just chatting and drinking and just becoming best friends, you know.
Our guest is Faces keyboard player Ian McLagan. He's just produced a box set of their recordings and live performances. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is musician Ian McLagan. In the 60s and 70s, he played keyboards for the British bands Small Faces and later Faces. He also toured with the Rolling Stones and Bob Dylan, and now he's produced a new box set of Faces songs just released. He lives in Austin and has his own group, Ian McLagan and the Bump Band. Well, Ian McLagan, when Faces split up, you were known in the music business. I guess you lived in the States at that point, right, in L.A.?
No, I moved to L.A. in 78. The Faces broke up the end of 75.
Okay. But yeah. but you'd stayed in touch with the Stones, with Mick Jagger, with Keith Richards, and they eventually invited you to collaborate on a recording session and go on tour. What was that like?
Keith and Woody invited me to go to Paris from London just for a weekend, which kind of, you know, hotels were seen, beds were seen and made, but weren't slept in, you know, and we just played and just played nonstop for days. And then I got back to London eventually when the album came out, which was Some Girls, and I'd played on Miss You and Just My Imagination. When they started to tour, getting ready to tour in 78, Keith asked me if I would tour with him. I said, boy, yeah, not many. And I jumped on a plane and toured with them and then stayed in America. Well, I went back to England, but then we moved straight after that. I just, I liked America at that time. England was, there was nothing going on for me, you know.
You know, I read in your book that you played on those recording sessions for the Stones track, Some Girls, and shocked to discover that they never paid you for that session.
Well, they did, but, you know, I mean, I was there as a guest. You know, I mean, I was, you know, I wasn't really, I hadn't been hired. I was there to socialize, really. But I said to Mick, is there any chance of any cash? And I think he gave me the equivalent. I was either 120 francs or 120 pounds. Didn't really pay for my cab fare, but.
Well, so you eventually end up touring with the Stones, which must have been a thrill. I mean, you admired them all these years.
Absolutely, yeah.
But you had a couple of awkward moments with Mick Jagger where he talked to you about payment, what you wanted to get paid, right?
Well, yeah, I mean,
Guys were multimillionaires at this point, weren't they?
Yeah. Well, this was at the end of the tour. They wanted to record in L.A., and so I hung on there for a couple of weeks while we waited to get in the studio. And Mick had a conversation with me about money over a game of pool. And he's not really a drinker, Mick, you know, and I am a professional drinker. And so we had a beer together, and the reason he came over to the house was to discuss business, and I didn't know. I just thought he wanted a game of pool. Well, he got more and more drunk, and he said, "So how much do you want?" And I said, "Well, how long do you want to record?" And he said, 2 weeks. I said, 15 grand. And he said, "I'm not paying you 50. He thought I'd said 50 instead of 15. He said, "I'll give you 20, and that's the end of it." And I said, "Okay." Well, of course, the next day, he completely forgot about this conversation. And then, you know, we screwed around for several days with his employees as to, you know, deciding on what I'd be paid. And eventually I did get my 15, but not after a lot of argument.
You played with Bonnie Raitt and a whole lot of other artists. I mean, you became a fairly sought-after session musician, I guess. You declined a chance to play with the Grateful Dead. Why was that?
Well, I didn't actually decline the chance. Yes, it was a chance. I wasn't given the gig. A friend of mine, who was a friend of Jerry Garcia's, said they're looking for their current keyboard player has died, and they're looking for someone else. He said they want you to play to a tape and submit it, you know. And he said, "You'd make $250,000 a year, you know. You could live anywhere you want, blah blah blah." And I was actually on vacation at the time in San Diego with my wife and our dogs, and I went out and bought a Grateful Dead CD, and my wife went out to do some shopping and came back to the hotel room, and I was sitting in a blue funk in a brown study in a green swarm of hell. And she said, "What's the matter?" I said, "I can't play this music. It sucks." I mean, just my personal taste. I didn't understand it, didn't get it. You know, still don't really. I mean, I know they make a lot of money. They got lots of fans. I'm sorry if I've upset anyone, but, you know.
Wasn't your cup of tea.
Wasn't my cup of tea. No more than Fish. All that jam band. That's so tediously boring. But, you know, I like a tune. I like a tune and a singer and a solo. And now more of the tune. Yeah, I just couldn't even do it, you know.
Well, you now live in Austin, Texas, and are continuing to make tunes. You have a group, Ian McLagan and the Bump Band. I thought maybe we'd hear a track off your latest latest CD, which is called Rise and Shine. Maybe the lead track, You're My Girl.
That would be fine, yeah. This is written about Kim, as most of the tracks are, it turns out. Turns out to be a love album. There's, I think, four, maybe five. Although I say She Ain't Mine is not about her. She thinks some of it is. But yeah, You're My Girl would be a good one to play.
All right, let's hear You're My Girl. This is Ian McLagan and the Bump Band from their CD Rise and Shine. That was You're My Girl from the CD Rise and Shine by my guest Ian McLagan and the Bump Band. That's nice organ playing on Rise and Shine. What do you think? How do you think your music has evolved? How is it different than it was when you were in Faces?
I don't think it's any different, actually. I mean, my influence, the music I choose to listen to is the same. I listen to the blues mainly, and I also listen to country. I love Hank Williams. But I mean, my influence is the same. I'm constantly trying to steal licks from Otis Spann and Johnny Johnson and Mead Lux Lewis and you know, all those great piano players. And I'm constantly polishing the same stone. That's really all I'm doing. I think that's all you can do.
You know, I have to ask you, with all of the drug use that you did and have owned up to, and you have a son, Lee, Kim has a kid. What's your attitude toward drugs nowadays with kids?
Well, you know, I don't think pot is so bad. I must say alcohol probably causes more damage to other people. I mean, a pot smoker isn't going to go crazy with a knife. He just could fall asleep. But I don't condone heavy hard drugs at all. I don't like them. And it's funny, the thing with E, you know, ecstasy. When I heard about that and I heard the music, especially in England, the music that goes with that, I said, don't ever anyone spike me with that. Please don't make me take that drug, because I don't want to be ending up liking that music. That would be the worst thing in my life. The great thing is we smoked pot and listened to the blues, you know, and soul, R&B. You know, it was like it seemed like it went with the music.
A lot of the guys that you shared, you know, a touring, recording, and performing life with, I mean, Ron went on to some pretty remarkable things. I mean, Ron Wood still plays with the Stones. Rod Stewart, you know, does his thing out there and plays at arenas. I mean, you do music, but at a sort of a more modest scale there in Austin. And I'm kind of wondering, do you like it better that way, or do you wish you were out there in front of these huge crowds doing it differently?
It's such a good question. You know, when I first joined the Small Faces, I was so happy because, as I said, I was playing every night, playing with people who wanted to play. And we'd play after gigs. We'd just play, you know, in a hotel room. We'd just, like, be playing and talking, listening to music. Well, I did an interview for a magazine called Beat Instrumental, which was about gigs and musicians, and, you know, in the current scene, back in 65. And they asked me, what did I see in the future, you know? And it's amazing what you say sometimes. And I actually said this. I said, I picture myself in a smoky club playing rhythm and blues. Well, hello, it came true, and I shouldn't complain because I love it still. I just wish I could make more money at it, but it's what I love to do. We play every Thursday night, and it's exactly the same. That's what I envisioned.
Would you rather play for 100 people rather than 20,000?
No, but I'd rather I had a roadie. The Hammond organ is a very heavy item, and I'm 59. I don't want to be doing it when I'm 60. I want to be able to afford a roadie. So if I could play for maybe 250 people, that would be better.
So you wouldn't have to set up the Hammond.
Well, that's right.
You fell in love with the Hammond organ. In fact, there was one point when the Faces broke up that you went across continents trying to retrieve one you had. Are they still around? I mean, can you still find and play a Hammond?
Yeah, actually, they're to be found in a lot of churches, and sadly, when a church, for whatever reason, goes downhill, they sell their Hammonds or other organs, and they're often in perfect condition because they've never traveled. You know, my I call her Betty, but I've had her since 1969. That's what you hear on Maggie May and on all the Faces stuff, and that's what you hear in all my records. She's been with me all that time, and she's really too. I mean, she's been around the world a few times. She's been beaten up, and you know, she's been damaged a little bit more than some Holiday Inn rooms. But you can still find them. I found a beautiful one in 1994 or 93 for $500. She's my pride and joy. She's in my studio at home and will never tour.
Well, do you play Betty because of the sentimental attachment, or does she have a sound that you just can't get anywhere else?
I've worked on her. I mean, over the years, she's a bit of a hybrid. She's a racehorse, you know, not just a plow horse. She's built for speed and built for sound, built for volume. She can, you know, electric guitarists like to think they're loud. You know, they can't top me. I can finally compete.
Well, Ian McLagan, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Dave, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Ian McLagan. He's just produced a CD box set of his former band, Faces. He now lives in Austin, Texas, and has his own group, The Bump Band. Ian McLagan is in New York City tonight to perform at the McCore Center, and he'll do a performance at the Virgin Megastore on Union Square tomorrow at 6:30. Coming up, Terror on the Seas, a review of Open Water. This is Fresh Air. The new film Open Water was inspired by the true story of a couple that was accidentally left on the open sea by their charter boat while scuba diving. The filmmakers went all out for realism, putting their actors in the water for weeks, at times with live sharks. David Edelstein has this review.
When you see a movie like Open Water, you do a lot of thinking about what makes for a good story, and why horror movies often get a pass if they don't have one but still shake you up. You're reminded at the start that this is based on a real event. And it's the realness that's the hook. No special effects, no movie stars, live sharks. A husband and wife, attractive but not by film actor standards heart-stopping, leave for a Bahamas vacation. Their talk is ordinary, and so is the camera work. It's totally flat. That's not to say it's bad. To be bad, it would need to attempt something, besides presenting the most mundane behavior in the most mundane way. It's good insofar as it makes you think, hey, that could be me. The couple's trip on the scuba diving boat is ordinary, too. The guides recite their standard speeches and say, yeah, you might see a shark, but if you don't want to, just close your eyes. Then it's everybody in, the first non-mundane moment in the film. It's when the divers are shot from way down below, splashing and wriggling and looking so yummy. You've probably heard that much of Open Water is the main characters, Susan, played by Blanchard Ryan, and Daniel, played by Daniel Travis, bobbing in the water up and down, the camera at their level, waiting for their boat to return. For a while, they think they came up in the wrong spot. How could the people running the scuba business, so safety-conscious, not realize two divers were still down at the reef? They joke about Shark Week on the Discovery Channel and warm each other up by peeing. You get to like these two, to think of their relationship as a wave. Daniel cradles Susan, Susan cradles Daniel. Each takes a turn, keeping the other afloat. Inevitably, they fight.
Do you honestly, seriously, honey, do you honestly think that we got left behind because we were late? I'm serious. Do you have any idea how idiotic that sounds?
Oh, so now I'm an idiot? Well, we are where we are, aren't we?
Yeah, fine. Yes, because of me.
You refused to swim.
Oh, yes.
My God, there were boats all around us, and you refused. And now, look, look around us. We are stuck in the middle of the ocean with nobody.
Even if we had been swimming for the last 5 hours, we would not be any closer to a boat than we are now.
It's quite a challenge making a movie in which the characters are stuck in one place for a full hour, the only action coming when they get nipped at by little things, and then nipped at by much bigger things. Once in a while, the filmmakers, Chris Kentis and Laura Lau, cut to the resort where Susan and Daniel are supposed to be, to people with sweet drinks and coconuts, dancing like there's no tomorrow. Then it's back to our couple, for whom there might not be. It's pitch black, and more sharks are circling. And the only time we can see is when the lightning flashes. And then we see more than we want to, like the tails of the circling sharks. We see human and shark from underneath, too, accompanied by sad a cappella island spirituals, not a hopeful portent. I won't spoil the ending, but it's fair to say that taken as a story, this is no more interesting than the Blair Witch Project, which was basically three people walking around and around, and the camera so jittery that many of us got seasick. Open water induces seasickness, too, but mostly dread sickness, from what you can't see coming. And what a strange thing to want to put ourselves through this and say, that's entertainment. Anthropologists have said that we're not running from saber-toothed tigers anymore, but we still have this leftover fight-or-flight mechanism that needs periodically to get taken out for a walk, or in this case, a swim. This desire to feel so helpless and threatened that we revert to a primitive state. It's a huge box office draw, and this little no-budget movie, like Blair Witch, has it down to a science, the science of torture. I know some people will have a good laugh, give thanks to be safe in the theater, and go out for seafood. But all I could think was that I'd seen something sadistic, a movie that used my innate love of being scared and my capacity for empathy against me, a true exploitation movie. And I thought, yuck.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, and Megan Howell. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Ian Chillog directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dial Press, publisher of The Rule of Four, a debut suspense novel of the puzzling connection between an ancient manuscript and an Ivy League murder by Ian Caldwell and Dustin Thomason. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with James Bennett, who just completed his assignment as Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. His story, A Nation Unto Himself, Where is Ariel Sharon Leading Israel, is on the cover of this Sunday's New York Times magazine. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air.